Hi, I'm William Tullett from Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge.
And I'm Hannah McCann from the University of Melbourne in Australia.
And welcome to the Pandemic Sensory Archive, a collection of voices from sensory experts on the fate of the five senses during and after the COVID-19 pandemic.
This project has been sponsored by the British Academy, and we hope that you enjoy the interview.
Okay, welcome back to the Pandemic Sensory Archive. Today I'm talking to Stephen Sullivan. And I'm going to start by asking you, Stephen, if you could just sort of describe who you are, what you do, and what your expertise is when it comes to the senses.
Sure. So I'm currently a cultural anthropology PhD candidate at Northwestern University. And my research is on the relationship between gentrification and sound. So I'm interested in questions of how contestations over space and the changing character of a neighborhood are also about sound and the sound environment, and sort of how evaluations about sound, relationships to sound, are changed in the process of living in a gentrifying neighborhood. And so I was trained in sound ethnography as part of my graduate school research, which is a research methodology that uses traditional ethnographic methods like participant observation and interviewing, but also is more sound-focused methods like sound walks, archival work, field recordings. And sort of what guides my research and also just my own intellectual interest is how people listen to the city, the relationship between sound and urban space, and then how sound becomes politicized. So whether this is through policing, like through noise complaints, for example, or on the other hand, using music or noise making as forms of protest, and then also just more everyday interactions within and around sonic cultures.
Excellent. So do you want to sort of give a sense, because I think you said you started your research before the pandemic, but then you ended up doing a lot of field work during the pandemic as well, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
So what kinds of things were you expecting to find in your research when you sort of started before the pandemic?
So I started my field work September of 2019, and so the idea was to do a full year of research. And so I was about halfway when the pandemic hit, and so during that first half it was sort of doing my original project, which I think was much more focused on the kind of everyday interactions. I was going to public parks, going to a lot of community events, community board meetings, just kind of public gatherings and, you know, different things that would pop up in the community, and sort of just talking with people and getting to know, like, you know, what is sort of the soundtrack of this neighborhood and you know, what sounds do you associate and how is it changing with given all the changes spurred by gentrification? But then sort of as the pandemic hit, obviously I had to stop in-person field research immediately. And there's a period where I think I and a lot of people who are currently in the midst of field work were kind of figuring out, do we just sort of stop and wait this out? You know, there's no sense of how long the lockdown would go on and when it would be safe to continue research. And so eventually I ended up transitioning to conducting virtual research. And so a lot of the, so I had been working with a grassroots organizing collective sort of involved with anti-gentrification activism in this neighborhood in Brooklyn. And I continued going to their meetings, which had then transitioned to being held on Zoom and online platforms. And so a lot of it continued, but then I sort of lost the ability to talk to people that I wasn't forming more stronger connections with. And so it became a lot more focused on the activism that was going on and sort of noticing the changes of, okay, what does being in lockdown mean for one's ability to engage in activism? And at least for the early parts of the lockdown, it completely was online. A lot of Zoom gatherings and information sessions, a lot of communicating over Signal and other secure messaging apps. and just sort of transmitting messages on social media. So it certainly put a lot of limitations on what was possible. But then also something I've written about is sort of the innovations that I think that that limitation of being in lockdown, that stuck at home for most of us, enabled, which, for example, there was a particular form of noisemaking called the Casalarazo, which is a popular form of protest in Latin America against austerity. And it was sort of imported by Latinx Brooklyn housing activists as a way to amplify their message, demanding that Governor Cuomo cancel rent, given that rent was still being collected despite many people being out of work and unable to, you know, have a steady source of income. So I think that's just like one example of how, at least in terms of the activism that was going on, it still continued, but it was in a much different form.
So it's interesting. So in some ways, the pandemic meant that as a researcher engaged with sound, you were far more reliant on other ear witnesses rather than your own ears, I suppose, than you would have been otherwise. So you sort of, I guess you weren't able to do those kinds of sound walks and those kinds of methodologies.
Right. Yeah. So I had initially planned to do, so sound walks are a method that involve walking with other people, so interlocutors, through a given space, in my case, this neighborhood I was working in, and just sort of having them listen to the neighborhood and make live observations as we're walking through. It could be a pre-planned route, or maybe we just kind of improvise and go wherever interests us at the time. And they can be recorded or not, but it's almost sort of like a live walking interview, but it allows you to really engage with the kind of the everyday spaces of a neighborhood or of a given space. And so that obviously I couldn't do with others at the time of the lockdown. Eventually, sort of as there was more knowledge about how the virus was transmitted and it felt relatively safe to go on walks, I would go on my own solo walks, solo sound walks, and sort of pay attention to, you know, how these neighborhood spaces that I was so keenly aware of before the pandemic had changed. And so, for example, I walked to, there's a major subway station that sort of is the meeting point between my neighborhood in Queens and the neighborhood I was studying in Brooklyn, Bushwick. And that normally is so busy and so filled with, you know, people gathering and hanging out at this little plaza. There are usually tables set up, street vendors, street food. And that was, you know, almost entirely silent, you know, except for the sounds of the subway train going to and from the station occasionally. And that was pretty eerie. But then as you suggested, yes, like I was relying on sort of communicating with people on through my phone and sort of asking, you know, what are the sounds you're hearing and you know, how has it changed? And I think relying on sort of broader narratives that were circulating on social media and you know, say for like example, the New York Times as sort of a comparison between, you know, the people that I was working with and then kind of brought more broader narratives about the city. And so I think the one that really stood out early on was the city's quieter. And that was sort of the grand narrative that there was a big piece in the New York Times of sound researchers who had taken decibel recordings and sort of compared it to what was typical of the city pre-pandemic. And sort of a broad trend was that the city was quieter. But of course, that's a very sort of particular assessment of sound and one that's more quantitative and scientific. And sort of my work, I'm more interested in the kind of the social aspects of it and the sort of textures to urban sound that are particular to a given place and particular communities. And so what I was also observing was how dependent it was on where you were located in the city. So if you were close to a hospital, for example, there were reports of people just really not being able to sleep, the constant sirens from ambulances as people were being rushed into the hospital. And then also in my neighborhood, I lived on a pretty busy thoroughfare in Queens, a lot of commercial buildings and you know, people were still sort of going to work, trucks were still having to make deliveries. So in a lot of ways, actually, my soundscape in my particular part of the neighborhood didn't really change a whole lot. There was still a lot of activity, and I didn't have this sense of complete isolation that I think for a lot of people, the relative silence tended to mark.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, because I guess whenever somebody says, you know, the city has become quieter, the question is for whom has it right. become quieter? And there are all kinds of things about the relationship between, okay, some public spaces might have been quieter, but what about, you know, in highly populated tenement blocks, for example, or in flats where people are at home more of the day, there will be more noise around you, I suppose, than there would be ordinarily. I mean, your mention of the hospital is a really interesting one, and I wonder whether, you know, is there a pattern to, do you think, to the areas that sort of have become quieter in the pandemic, and those areas that seem to have either become noisier or which haven't really changed as much in terms of the level of sound? I'm thinking particularly kind of patterns that are already kind of predetermined by inequalities of all sorts, and whether in fact the pandemic just kind of exacerbated those existing inequalities in the way the soundscape works. Is that something that you sort of came across at all?
Yes, absolutely. I think most apparently was the class dimensions to a lot of these observations. So I think a lot of what I was reading about the silence and the kind of longing for a return to urban noise as kind of this general sensibility and sensory experience sort of was circulating in the New York Times, and a lot of it was from residents who were living in Manhattan. Later, I think there were reports about how a lot of the people that sort of left the city upon the lockdown were in the more affluent areas in Manhattan. And so naturally that with sort of just the migration of people out of Manhattan, it also that contributed to the silence. I think also a lot of the narratives about this idea that there was a loss of sound, a kind of part of that was also complemented by this fascination with natural sounds. So birds and animals taking up a bigger presence in the soundscape as other parts were silenced. And I think there was sort of like there's a novelty there and a romanticism that, of course, I'm not sure that you would get in perhaps like a working class neighborhood or a neighborhood where you're, you know, very close to hospitals, very close to a lot of grocery stores and you know, all of that, and how that would not necessarily change the soundscape a whole lot, or in the case of the ambulances in a more negative way. So, yeah.
It's interesting. One of the sounds that you sort of mentioned already is the sound of protest. And clearly, you know, the last year and a half or so has been a period when, you know, the sound of protest has been very audible, whether that's in terms of things like protests over rent, for example, or whether that's the broader kind of Black Lives Matter protests, which are not just in the US, of course, but highly global. Do you think that, you know, the relative silence or this kind of discourse about silence, which is kind of highly middle class, I guess, you know, has that kind of rendered the sound of protest more effective somehow, or kind of made the sound of protest more noticeable, or changed people's reactions to the sound of protest, do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think so. In my writings about this so far, I've kind of used, as I mentioned before, the Casa Larrazo, this noise making that's popular in Latin America that was used by housing activists in Brooklyn. I think part of what made those effective was that relative silence and sort of, you know, there is a way that I think that sound as produced by people resisted quarantine and in the ways that, you know, being stuck at home meant that you were more attuned to what was going on. It was a way of marking your own presence and hearing other people's presence. And I think that was also pretty evident in why the 7 p.m. Clapping ritual took off. So this was a ritual where everyday people were every night at 7 p.m., standing outside their windows or doors or balconies and clapping and applauding frontline workers, and most especially medical workers. And that gained a lot of virality online and on traditional media, and was something that a lot of elected officials also celebrated as part of, as an example of sort of, at least in the case of New York that I was focused on, like New York's resiliency. And the governor at the time was using this message of New York tough as a way of celebrating the kind of this idea that our response to the pandemic was patriotic and about our resilience. And, you know, in my view, kind of obfuscated a lot of the more policy-oriented responsibility that, you know, for example, and this is where the comparison comes in, that the Brooklyn housing activists were saying, well, no, we, you know, we're suffering. This isn't sort of a celebratory moment. This is one where we need assistance, and we need it immediately because rent's about to be due and a lot of us are out of work. And so I think that that central dynamic of what did lockdown being, what did being in lockdown mean for you, and how we then used noise or sound or these sorts of things in response to that to amplify a certain message, whether that's thanking frontline workers, demanding housing justice. You know, I think the relative quiet of the city certainly gave a bigger stage and sort of really shined a light on these sound practices and how they filled that that relative void, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, I think the clapping one's particularly interesting as well, isn't it? Because it's an example, a bit like the minute silence, for example, as a mode of commemoration, in that, you know, everybody can be clapping, but your individual reasons for clapping or the way that you respond emotionally to that might be quite distinctive and idiosyncratic. It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's feeling exactly the same thing or clapping for exactly the same reasons. And yet, as you suggest, you know, politicians, for example, are able to force a particular interpretation on these rituals, sound rituals, to make it seem like simply an act of patriotism, for example, or simply a demonstration of resilience. Do you think then that, you know, given that your work is sort of on gentrification and the soundscapes of gentrification, do you think that the pandemic has or will alter the soundscapes of gentrification in meaningful ways? Or do you think that this is kind of a blip insofar as the kinds of soundscapes we associate with gentrifying neighborhoods?
I think it certainly has changed our relationship to the senses. And I'm not quite sure sort of how long that will linger, just because I know the lockdown especially was such a disruption to the senses. And I don't know that, you know, as things return to sort of a new normal, there will be anything quite on that scale. But I think now, especially now as we're recording this, as sort of people are reacquainting themselves to life beforehand, a lot of the narratives I've seen circulating is an appreciation of sounds of, say, people in a movie theater, if you're returning to the movies, or at a restaurant or a bar, or even just hearing street vendors alive again. Or music coming from certain areas and public spaces. And I think all of those are sort of part of also the experience of gentrification, is sort of figuring out what is characteristic of a neighborhood, and a lot of the nostalgia and memories that I think that those kinds of music genres or noises or sounds conjure. And certainly, I think a lot of people are reappreciating the ability to hear those again. And, you know, I think there is this return, but I think there also, while that's also true, there's also a sense of loss in what was. I mean, a lot of people were displaced because of the pandemic. And so I think there's a real reckoning with the differential effects of the pandemic and life under lockdown that, you know, are being negotiated through the senses. And yeah.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see then, I think, you know, what character that renegotiation takes on, whether it will be a kind of reacceptance of the kind of noisiness of the city, or whether there will be a continued kind of selective idealizing emphasis on some noises and sounds and silencing of others as we move on over the next sort of couple of years. Well, thank you, Stephen. It's really interesting discussion, and I look forward to hearing about where your research goes next, and good luck.
Thank you so much.